28. December 20th, 1972. Dear Barb, thanks for the birthday card. I'm writing an identical letter to Ethel. Should I call? Yeah. Sure. Of course. I just can't. Maybe I'm becoming a coward in my old age. I'm not sure. Anyway, I'll cut to the chase. I'm pregnant. Who saw that coming, right? Although I do recall you mentioning birth control a million years ago when I lost my virginity. Henry and I are getting married. I know, it's a lot and fast, and I'm a modern woman. I can raise a child on my own, but, well, there's something special about Henry. I think I'll learn to love him. More importantly, it seems impossible, but I'm already in love with the baby in my womb. How can that be? Sometimes I'm giddy and embarrassed by how much I want this. Her, I think. The wedding won't be much, probably something small in our backyard or on the beach. You'll come? Be my maid of honor? Ethel can be the matron of honor. She'll love how old that makes her sound. Love ya. F. Henry slipped his grandmother's diamond ring on Frankie's finger on Christmas morning, saying, "Forever, Frankie, and longer." They decided on Saturday, February 17th for the wedding and sent out a small number of casual, handwritten invitations. Henry taught Frankie how to spin a dream into something tangible, a nursery. They started with furniture, bought a crib and a changing table, and then went to the hardware store together early on a Saturday morning and picked out a sunny shade of yellow for the walls. They spent the next two weekends and several weekday evenings readying the small bedroom at the end of the hallway. A yellow room with big windows and new gingham drapes. Henry was sitting on the floor now, with white crib pieces scattered all around, counting out screws, swearing under his breath. "Why in the hell do they give you more screws than there are holes?" Smiling, Frankie left him with the incomprehensible instructions and headed to the kitchen. It took forever to wash the yellow paint off of her hands and cheeks. It was even in her hair, and she'd worn a kerchief. At last, she started dinner and made an apple pie for dessert.
"Something smells good," Henry said an hour later when he walked into the kitchen.
"That's me," Frankie said. He took her in his arms, pulled her close.
"I love a woman who smells like apples and cinnamon. You made a pie?"
"From scratch, I might add. It's Ethel's family recipe." She smiled. Pregnancy had calmed her. For the first time in years, she was sleeping well. Her moods had evened out. Finally, she thought, she was becoming herself again.
"I assume you'll start knitting booties or making your own baby food."
Frankie smiled. "Are you suggesting I'm going overboard on the whole nesting thing?"
"Never."
He kissed her, then led her down the hallway to the nursery. In the soft yellow room with bright white trim, the new crib stood against one wall. She went to the crib, touched the Rocket and Stars mobile that hung over it, remembering the disagreement they'd had about this mobile. Should it be rockets or princess castles?
"I want our daughter to know she can fly to the moon if she wants to," had been Henry's winning argument.
A new rocker sat in the corner, next to an empty bookcase that she would soon fill with her favorite childhood stories. She sat down in it, pushed off with her feet. The chair made a creaking, clacking sound on the floor. She bumped the bookcase, and a stuffed blue octopus fell into her lap. Idly, she stroked its soft, fake fur. Henry moved closer, gazed down at her, his clothes splattered with yellow, his graying hair a ragged mess. "I love you," she said. And just then, as he pulled her up for a kiss, she thought it was true. Or at least, that it could be true. She wanted it to be true. In the first week of the new year, 1973, they started a tradition of weekly dinners with Frankie's parents. Dad and Henry never seemed to run out of topics to talk about, even though their political views differed. The clinic Henry and his colleagues had worked so hard to create was months away from opening, and he could wax poetic about their big plans to help addicts and alcoholics heal.
Mom had offered to spearhead another fundraising campaign with other junior league wives. She was already shopping for a gown for the opening. Dad seemed thrilled that his daughter had finally stepped onto the accepted female life path, marriage and motherhood. Mom talked excitedly about the wedding, pressed for a small reception at the club after the backyard ceremony, a request that Frankie politely denied. Now they were in the living room, gathered in comfortable chairs around the fireplace with a fire roaring. The television in the corner was on. Cronkite was reporting on the Watergate scandal. The aroma of pot roast wafted in from the kitchen. In the middle of the broadcast, Frankie got up from her chair and headed to the bathroom. She was back in the hallway, heading for the living room, when Henry appeared, looking worried.
"Are you okay? You look pale."
"I'm Irish," she said, "and I currently have a bladder the size of a pea, which I'm pretty sure our daughter is sitting on." He put a hand on her belly, leaned down to say,
"Hey, baby, Daddy's here."
Frankie's pregnancy was barely showing. There was just the tiniest bump in her belly, which she touched often, stroked, imagining her baby, a daughter, she still thought, like a little fish in there, swimming around, doing effortless somersaults. She had begun recently to touch her belly frequently, saying, "Come on, baby, do a little twirl for Mama, let me feel you." But she knew it was too early. "Mama wants a little attention, too," Frankie said, taking Henry by the hand, leading him down the hallway. She opened her father's office door, pulled him inside. Henry kissed her, then said,
"Okay, we've hidden out long enough. Your mom's going to send a SWAT team in after us."
He pulled back. Frankie realized her mistake. In the past few weeks since the night of their engagement, she'd taken great care not to show Henry this room, to bypass the closed door. Now he'd seen the hero's wall. She tried to pull him away.
"Wow."
He let go of her hand, moved toward the wall, staring at the photographs and mementos. Frankie moved to his side, kept one arm around his narrow waist. She hadn't been in this room for years. The last thing she wanted to see was Finley's American flag, folded into a neat triangle, protected behind glass, framed in wood.
"Where's your picture?"
Henry asked, and she loved him for noticing the absence and not being afraid to remark upon it. Before she could answer, the door behind them opened. Dad strode into the room, moving as he always did, with authority.
"We are so proud of our family's service," Dad said.
"The men's service," Frankie remarked. Mom arrived a second later, a martini in hand.
"I hope you haven't told them without me," she said.
"Of course not," Dad said.
He reached into his desk drawer and pulled out a fat, sealed manila envelope.
"This is the deed to the cottage on Ocean Boulevard. It's our wedding gift to you."
"That's very generous," Henry said with a frown.
"I say a toast is in order," Mom said. "Henry, please, come help me choose a bottle of champagne."
Mom tucked her arm through Henry's and pulled him away. That left Frankie alone at the hero's wall with her father. They stood there a long moment, staring up at the pictures and memorabilia.
"Why isn't there a picture of me up there, Dad?"
"We'll put your wedding photo up. That's what we do for the women in this family. You're a hero for putting up with the men."
How many times had he made that joke? "Nurses died in Vietnam, Dad."
"I'm uncomfortable with this conversation. Your fiancé is here. You're expecting a child. Your pride should come from caring for your husband and child. Women going to war."
He shook his head.
"If I'd been a son who went to Vietnam and came home in one piece, would my photograph be on the wall, Dad?"
"You're upsetting me with this jabble, Frankie. You're my daughter. You had no business going to war, and I told you so at the time. Now we find out we shouldn't even have been fighting the damn war in the first place, and we are losing. America, losing a war. Who wants that reminder? Let it go, Frankie. Forget and move on."
He was right. She needed to forget it. She was engaged to be married, pregnant.
Why should she care if no one, including her own family, valued her service to her country? Why should she care that no one remembered the women? She remembered. Why wasn't that enough? Suddenly, the door to the office banged open. Henry stood there, holding a bottle of champagne.
"It's over," he said.
"Over?" Frankie said.
"The war,"
Henry said.
"Nixon signed the peace accord."
2 weeks after President Nixon signed the peace accord, it was announced on the television news that the first wave of POWs would be coming home from Vietnam. Operation Homecoming, it was called, and overnight, the League of Families' efforts changed from advocacy to preparing for the POWs' return, some of whom had been gone for nearly a decade. Letters and postcards began to arrive at the League of Families' San Diego and D.C. offices, letters from all over the country from people who had worn a POW bracelet, glowing, welcome-home letters that thanked the men. Strangers sent gifts of gratitude, donations. A public that couldn't wait to get past the war embraced the return of the heroes released from the Wallo prison, a place that was just beginning to be written about as hell on earth, just beginning to be known by the public as the Hanoi Hilton. The wives launched their own Operation Homecoming by readying their homes, going to the beauty salon, gathering families close, painting welcome home banners. Children were lined up and spit polished. Many were told stories of the fathers they'd never met. On this February afternoon, the League of Families' San Diego office was decorated for a party, with banners hung on the walls, painted with slogans like "Never Forgotten" and "We Did It." There was a buzzing, nervous energy in the room. Frankie felt the women's pride and fear. She overheard several of them talking about the preparedness briefing the Navy had given the POW wives, who had been told not to expect too much from their husbands. They'd been given a flyer. "We don't know what shape the men will be in, physically or emotionally. As you know, there have been reports of torture. For these reasons, we suggest you plan your reunions carefully. Keep your husband in a quiet setting until he tells you he's ready for more. No big parties, no magazine or television interviews, no loud noises or big expectations. Some of these men, as you well know, have lived in captivity, in harsh conditions, for up to 8 years. This will have taken an extreme toll on their minds and bodies. Do not expect them to be themselves right away. We expect them to be sexually impotent and prone to hostility toward those they love." Torture. Captivity. Prone to hostility. How could men come home after years of such treatment and be anything but hostile? Frankie listened to the wives as they expressed their nervousness. "I've gained weight, lost my spark, not as young," and wondered aloud if the men they'd married would still love them. She listened to their plans to attend the return of the first group arriving in San Diego on Valentine's Day and felt a strong sense of pride. But as proud as she was of her service to the League, it was over now. She didn't belong in this room full of wives. She put down her empty cake plate and headed for the door.
"Frankie!"
She stopped, turned to see Joan moving toward her. The two women hadn't seen each other in months, but there was no mistaking the joy in the woman's eyes.
"I just wanted to say thank you," Joan said, touching her arm. "Your help meant so much."
Frankie smiled.
"Thanks, Joni. I'm glad your husband is coming home."
It was the perfect goodbye. One chapter in her life closing, Vietnam, and another opening up, marriage and motherhood. On the day the first group of POWs was scheduled to land in Manila, Frankie poured herself an iced tea and sat on the sofa watching TV. Walter Cronkite was saying, "There have been stories of torture, as we know. The men in the Hanoi Hilton, mostly pilots, devised an ingenious way of communicating with each other. Today, 108 of them will land in Manila, the first stop on their way home."
"Hey, babe,"
Henry said, scooting in beside her.
It's starting.
Frankie felt almost as anxious as the wives must be right now. This was really it, the end of the war. Grainy color images of the war filled the screen, then changed to images of Navy wife Sybil Stockdale speaking to the Senate, to audiences, to Henry Kissinger. Walter Cronkite narrated it all. The League of Families worked tirelessly to bring these American heroes home from their ordeal. Moments from now, a plane full of POWs will touch down at Clark Air Force Base. In 2 days, they will step on American soil for the first time in years. And then, it's here. The jet has landed at Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines, ladies and gentlemen. Frankie leaned forward. On screen, a jet rolled down the runway. Lights blared on the scene. The jet came to a slow, bumping stop. Images of a cheering, jostling crowd, men and women straining at a barricade to keep them back. The camera focused on a sign that read, "Homecoming 1973. We love you, John." The jet door opened. All but one of these men who flew to freedom were shot down during some of the fiercest fighting of the war. Here is Navy Commander Benjamin E. Strahan, shot down in September of 1967, and Air Force Major Jorge Alvarez, shot down in October 1968. Men emerged one at a time from the plane, saluted, and walked down the ramp. They looked skinny, but their hair was regulation short, and they stood tall. A few limped. A man stepped out of the plane, saluted to the crowd gathered on the tarmac. Navy Lieutenant Commander Joseph Ryerson Walsh, shot down in March of 1969, presumed dead until a year ago. Frankie straightened. Rye shuffled down the ramp, holding on tightly to the yellow railing. The way he walked was uneven, a limp maybe, and he held one arm in close to his body. At the bottom of the ramp, he saluted again. The camera closed in on Rye's gaunt, smiling face. Frankie stood up, stared at the television, at Rye. The thudding of her heart was so loud she couldn't hear anything else.
"Babe," Henry said. "Frankie, what's wrong?"
"I'm not feeling well. Nausea." An excuse that always worked for a pregnant woman. "I'm going to take a bath."
Henry stood.
"I'll start it for—"
"No!" Had she shouted it? Was she crying? She wiped her eyes, felt tears. She looked at him. "No,"
she said more gently as she could anyway, when all she wanted to do was get away.
"Stay. Watch the broadcast. I'll go calm down and relax in a nice hot bath."
She gave him a quick peck on the cheek, almost a headbutt because she was off balance, and lurched toward the kitchen. "He's alive." Those two words shifted the world off its axis, upset the precarious balance she'd found in the last year. The phone on the kitchen counter rang.
"I'll get it,"
Henry said.
"I've got it,"
Frankie shouted, diving forward to pick up the phone.
"Hello?"
Barb said.
"Frankie? You saw him?"
Frankie whispered.
"I saw him," Barb said. "Are you okay?"
"Okay,"
Frankie said, dragging the phone as far as she could, lowering her voice to a whisper.
"I'm pregnant. My wedding is this weekend, and the love of my life just came back from the dead. How could I be okay?"
She heard Barb's sigh slip through the line.
"What the hell are you supposed to do now? I mean, engaged is one thing, pregnant is another."
"I know, but it's Rye,"
she said quietly.
"I know. I have to see him at least,"
Frankie said. As she said the words, she knew they were a half-truth. She wanted more than just to see him. She wanted the future that belonged to them.
"I have to be on the airfield in San Diego when he lands."
There was a long silence. Then Barb said,
"I'm calling Ethel. We'll catch a red eye."
All the next day, Frankie was so nervous she couldn't sit still, not even when Barb and Ethel showed up to rally around her. All she could think about was Rye,
landing in San Diego, being alive.
You should tell Henry, Barb said. They were in the bungalow's living room, she and Frankie and Ethel.
Frankie's new wedding dress, a lacy white prairie-style gown, hung from a hanger on a kitchen cupboard hook, reminding them all of the wedding scheduled for Saturday.
I can't,
Frankie said. She knew it would break Henry's heart to learn that Joseph Ryerson Walsh, recently returned POW, was the Rye whom Frankie had loved. Still loved. She glanced nervously at the kitchen clock. It was 8:10 a.m. The plane full of POWs was scheduled to land in San Diego at 9:28. Frankie had called Ann Jenkins and gotten permission to be there. It had been easy to do on a day when Ann was busy with 1,000 other details.
Sure, she'd said. Of course. Thanks again for all your help, Frankie.
Frankie twirled her engagement ring on her finger, staring down at it, and then slowly took it off. She didn't want Rye to see it until she had time to explain.
If we're going, we should go, Ethel said.
They piled into Frankie's Mustang and drove off the island and onto the mainland and arrived at the gates of the Air Station Miramar at 8:45. There was already a crowd of people and reporters on the tarmac. Women, children, men, all holding up welcome home signs. Wives and family and reporters were in front, friends and service personnel in the back.
I forgot to make a sign, Frankie said. She was so nervous she couldn't think straight, couldn't stand still.
In the front of the line, reporters held out microphones, threw out questions. Barb and Ethel stood on either side of her like bodyguards, giving her time to collect herself. Would Rye forgive her for Henry, for being weak enough to say yes, for carrying another man's child? While he'd been held and tortured, she'd been having a relationship with someone else. How could she make him believe she'd never stopped loving him?
It's landing, Barb said.
Frankie glanced up, felt fear and joy in equal measure. Would he still love her? A different version of him meeting a different version of her? The C-141 medical evacuation jet descended, touched down on the runway, came to a stop. Reporters ran forward, stretching out microphones and video cameras, clamoring with questions, but were stopped by a barrier from getting too close to the plane. The three women were jostled by the crowd. A yellow line held all of the families back, but the wives and children strained against it, signs upheld, each jockeying to be in front. At the plane, sailors moved the exit ramp into place. A naval officer stood at the bottom of the ramp, holding the reporters and families at bay. The jet door opened, and the first POW emerged, wearing khakis that were too big for him. Commander James, shot down in 1967. He paused at the top of the ramp, blinked in the harsh sunlight, and made his way down to the tarmac. At the bottom, he saluted the officer in front of him and was helped to a podium, set up in front of a phalanx of reporters. He looked out at the crowd, searching for his family.
Thank you, America. We are grateful to have had the opportunity to serve our country, and grateful that our country has brought us home.
His wife broke free, pushed past the reporters, ducked under the yellow tape, and rushed toward her husband, throwing herself into his arms. The crowd spread out, families clumped together. Frankie saw Ann Jenkins standing with her children, and Joan and her daughter, and several of the other wives she'd met along the way. They all looked anxious, didn't even wave to each other. A commander emerged from the jet next. His wife and sons, and a man who was probably his father, moved forward to greet him. And then there he was, Rye, standing at the top of the ramp, blinking as the others had, wearing freshly pressed khakis that were too big, a belt cinched tight at his waist. He limped down the ramp, clutching the rail with one hand. Everything else fell away. The world around him blurred. Frankie saw the smear of camouflage-colored paint that was the jet and a blob of reporters vying for comments and heard the sound of sobbing all around her. She needed to push her way through the people in front of her to get to the yellow tape. But she could hardly move. She was crying too hard to see.
Rye, she whispered.
He limped forward, searching the crowd. Not seeing her, he veered left toward the group of waiting wives.
Rye!
She yelled, but her voice was lost in the sound of cheering.
I'm here!
He headed for a tall, curvy woman with a cascade of curly blonde hair who stood to one side, holding on to a little girl's hand. The child held up a sign that read, "Welcome home, Daddy." He ran the last few steps forward, pulled the woman into his arms and kissed her. Deeply. Then he bent down to kiss the little girl with the "Welcome home, Daddy" sign. He swept her up into his arms. The woman wrapped her arms around both of them. All three were crying.
He's married, Ethel said softly. Son of a bitch.
Oh my God, Frankie whispered, feeling everything inside of her start to crumble. 29. Frankie became aware of the music, first the beat, then the words, "Hey Jude." She was in the O Club, dancing with Rye. She felt his arms around her, his hand at the curve of her spine, familiar where it belonged, holding her close. He whispered something she couldn't hear.
What?
She said.
What?
I'm married. I was always married. Suddenly, the music blared, turned loud enough to break glass. She opened her eyes. They were groggy with grit, wet with tears. The music snapped off. She was in her own house, in her bed. She sat up, saw Barb and Ethel standing there, looking so sad that Frankie's wound opened again. He lied. She remembered asking him the wrong question in Kauai, and his answer, "I swear I'm not engaged." The words played over and over in her head.
You need to get up, honey, Ethel said. Henry is on his way over.
Frankie couldn't respond. She'd come home from the air station and climbed into bed and cried herself first to a headache and then to sleep. She knew her friends were ready to lift her up, buoy her, but this pain, this betrayal, was worse than her grief had been. She'd made her friends stop on the way home to buy a local newspaper. She'd read and reread the article about Joseph Rye Walsh, the local hero who had married his college sweetheart just before going off to war and never met the daughter who'd been born in his absence. Josephine, called Joey. Frankie, Barb said gently, sitting on the bedside, pushing the damp hair back from Frankie's face. Frankie pushed the sour-smelling covers back. Without making eye contact with her friends, she couldn't look at them without thinking of Rye. She got out of bed. Love and pain and humiliation almost toppled her again. She felt so stupid. Hadn't Ethel warned her early on? The men here, they lie and they die. She walked to the bathroom and ran a steaming hot shower and stepped underneath the hot flow. Let it pound her while she cried. In the empty kitchen, her gunny sack's dress hung limply from a high cupboard. She couldn't look at it, so she turned and went outside. Barb and Ethel were in the backyard, which had been transformed for this weekend's ceremony. Folding chairs, 11 of them, for Frankie's parents, Barb and Ethel, and Noah and Cecily, and Henry's small family, had been set up in front of a rented wooden arch, which Mom had insisted on festooning with white roses, as if Frankie were a naive debutante instead of a pregnant war veteran. 2 days ago, she'd been almost excited to marry Henry Acevedo and have his baby and start a new life. Today, she couldn't imagine any of that. Barb got out of the chair and came toward her. Ethel followed suit.
Henry loves you, Frank, Ethel said. That's obvious.
Do you love him? Barb dared to ask. The words submerged Frankie again, left her unable to straighten or breathe. She knew they would support her, these women, her best friends who had flown here at a moment's notice and were equally ready to stand at the altar with her or stand by her if she canceled the ceremony. They loved her,
were here for her. But she didn't want them here now, didn't want to see their pity. Away. That was what she wanted, a place to hide.
If you don't get married, Ethel said tentatively, come back to Virginia with me. The bunkhouse is still empty. Noah will love you, and Cecily needs an aunt to play with.
Or to Chicago with me, Barb said.
They were offering her paths, lives. They had no idea how broken she felt by Rye's betrayal. But her feelings weren't the most important anymore. She was going to be a mother.
I'll marry Henry on Saturday, she said quietly. What choice did she have?
He'll be a great father. Our baby deserves that.
She knew what the right thing to do was. If there was one true thing in her life, it was that she always knew the right thing and did it, even when it hurt so much she couldn't breathe. Rye had betrayed her, didn't love her. Henry loved her and their baby and wanted to create a family. The baby deserved that chance, and Frankie owed everything to her unborn baby.
You sure? Barb asked, reaching out to squeeze Frankie's upper arm. Frankie looked at her two best friends.
I'm going to be a mom, Frankie said. I guess my choices have to start there from now on.
Then this is our bridal party. Let's get it on, Ethel said.
She went back into the living room, cranked up the stereo, and opened the patio doors. The familiar notes of California Girls drifted into the backyard.
This song always reminds me of Frankie's first day at the 36th, Barb said to Ethel, pulling Frankie to dance with her on the patio. Her eyes were so big, they looked like burnt holes in my mama's best sheet. You guys stripped down to bloody bras and panties in front of me, Frankie said. I thought I'd landed on the moon.
The music changed again. Born to be Wild. Halfway through the song, Frankie felt a cramp in her stomach. First a tightening, then a pain so sharp she gasped. A rush of wetness dampened her underwear. She put a hand down her panties. When she brought her hand back up, it was covered in blood. Someone knocked on the door. Before anyone could answer, the front door opened. Henry walked into the backyard.
Hey, gals, that's some good music, and...
He saw the blood. Frankie looked at him. This can't be happening. I haven't done anything wrong.
Henry bounded into action, sweeping Frankie into his arms, carrying her out to the car, settling her in the passenger seat. He backed out of the driveway so fast Frankie smelled burning rubber. He sped up to the Coronado Hospital emergency entrance and slammed on the brakes. Lifting Frankie out of the car, carrying her into the bright white emergency room, he shouted,
"We need help here! My fiancé is pregnant and something is wrong!"
Frankie woke in a darkened room that smelled of disinfectant and bleach. Hospital. The previous night came back to her in a rush, blood running down her legs, a terrible cramping, a young doctor saying, "I'm sorry, Mrs. Acevedo, there's nothing I can do." Her saying, ridiculously, "I'm Frankie McGrath." She heard a chair creak beside her, saw Henry sitting there, slumped over.
"Hey," Frankie said. Just the sight of him saddened her. He was such a good man, and he deserved better.
She pressed a hand to her empty abdomen.
"Hey,"
Henry answered, rising, taking her hand in his. He leaned down to kiss her cheek.
"Was it
a boy?" Henry said. "Finley."
"The doctor said we can try again," Henry said.
There was a knock at the door. It opened. Mom stood there, dressed in a rust-colored suede skirt with a print vest over a blouse buttoned up to her throat and knee-high boots.
"How is she?"
Henry answered.
She's right here, Mom, and conscious.
Mom's smile turned brittle.
"Henry, darling, would you go get me a coffee from the cafeteria? I've got a headache."
Henry kissed Frankie, whispered, "I love you," and left the room. Mom approached the bed slowly.
Frankie thought her mother looked tired. Her makeup had been applied a little too heavily, and she couldn't hold a smile. As usual, when she was tired or stressed, the effects of her stroke were more noticeable. There was the slightest downturn to one side of her mouth.
I am so sorry, Frances.
Tears scalded Frankie's eyes, blurred the image of her mother.
God is punishing me. But I was going to do the right thing.
It's nothing you did.
Mom reached behind her neck, unclasped her necklace, and handed it to Frankie. As a child, Frankie had been obsessed with the necklace, wondering how that delicate gold chain could hold the obviously heavy heart. Mom pulled out her silver cigarette case, lit an Eve cigarette.
You're not supposed to smoke, you know, Frankie said.
Mom made a dismissive gesture.
Look on the back of the heart.
Frankie turned the necklace over, saw an inscription on the back. Celine. She frowned.
Who is Celine?
The daughter I lost, Mom said. The baby I was carrying when I married your father.
You never...
And I won't now, Frances, Mom said. Some things don't bear the weight of words. That's the problem with your generation. You all want to talk, talk, talk. What is the point? I thought you could give your child a name and engrave it there, below your sister's, and wear it.
He was a boy, Frankie said. We would have named him Finley.
Mom blanched. Some things don't bear the weight of words.
I'm so sorry, Frances. Put the pain away, forget about it, and go on.
Were you able to do that?
Most of the time.
Mom reached into her purse, pulled out two prescription bottles.
I know you're a nurse and all, but I swear by these pills. Cheryl Burnham calls them mother's little helpers. The white ones help you sleep, and the yellow ones keep you awake.
I am a nurse, Mom, and I read Valley of the Dolls.
Phew, those were bad girls. You just need something to take the edge off. These have hardly more kick than a gin martini.
Thanks, Mom.
I'll put them in your purse. Trust me, you and Henry will be married and expecting again in no time.
Frankie sighed.
Do you remember the man I fell in love with in Vietnam?
The pilot who was killed?
Yes, he...
Francis, enough Vietnam. For God's sake, that was years ago. Let it go. He's not coming back to you.
She closed her eyes in pain, unable to look at her mother anymore, unable to see pity and sorrow and know that it was for her. Barb and Ethel stood at Frankie's bedside. Their mission was obvious, to keep up a steady stream of banter, to talk about whatever they could think of, the commutation of Charles Manson's death sentence to life imprisonment, the rockiness of the Taylor-Burton marriage, the uproar over a movie called Deep Throat. Frankie couldn't listen anymore. She raised a hand. Ethel stopped talking. Frankie had no idea what she'd been talking about and leaned in.
What is it?
Frankie sat up, staring dry-eyed at the wall.
I'm not going to marry him, she said. It wouldn't be fair.
Give it some time, Ethel said. Don't decide now, after...
Say it, after losing my son.
Yeah, Barb said, holding Frankie's hand.
After losing your baby. I can't imagine your pain. Rye...
He lied to you, Frank, Ethel said.
Her voice had a sharp edge, but the tears in her eyes were obvious.
He had his men lie to you, or he lied to them. Either way, he's not good enough to lick shit off the floor, and if I ever see him...
I'll help you kick his ass, Barb said. I'll pay people to help us.
You can go home, Frankie said. There's no wedding to stay for. Ethel, your husband and daughter need you, and Barb, I know Operation Push's convention is coming up, and Jesse Jackson is probably counting on you.
We don't want to leave you, Barb said.
I'm fine, Frankie lied.
She touched the golden heart necklace at her throat. All three of them knew the truth, that it would be a long time before Frankie was really fine. But whatever that journey looked like, however she healed, it would fall on her to do the heavy lifting. Her friends could be there for her, help her stand, but she had to walk alone. They kissed her forehead, Ethel first, Barb next, her kiss a moment longer.
"We will call you tomorrow," Barb said.
"And the day after that," Ethel added.
Frankie was relieved when they left. She lay back into the pillows, feeling exhausted and afraid. The hospital door opened and she winced. Henry stepped into the room, closed the door behind him. He looked as tired and beaten as she felt. He came to her bedside, held her hand. She couldn't find the strength to squeeze his hand back. He smoothed the hair back from her face. She knew how badly he was hurting, how much he needed to share that with her. But she was a closed door. She closed her eyes, hating that she would hurt him.
"Don't shut me out, Frankie," Henry said. "I need you. Us. This happened to both of us. The doctor says we need to put it aside and try again. We can do that, can't we?"
Forget it, in other words. The same old advice given for a brand new pain. God help her, she wasn't able to mourn with him. Even now, with loss all around her, in her own body, she couldn't help thinking of Rye. His was the touch she wanted.
"I'm sorry," he said, and his voice broke. "I should have been there earlier."
She looked at him, felt a hot rush of self-loathing.
"It would have happened anyway," she said tonelessly. "I know, but no buts, Henry. I don't want to talk about the baby."
She took a deep breath.
"I want to talk about the wedding. About us." "Us? Oh, babe, don't worry about the wedding. We have time. Let's just get our feet under us."
She looked at him, seeing how deeply he loved her.
"Henry,"
she sighed, played with her engagement ring, his grandmother's.
"You remember I told you about Rye, the man I loved in Vietnam, Finley's friend?"
He drew back, let go of her hand.
"Sure. The pilot who was killed?" "He didn't die over there. He's been in prison. He got back to the U.S. yesterday."
"Oh." He said it lightly, and then he frowned, said it again.
"Oh. You saw him?"
"I did."
"And you still love him?"
"I do,"
Frankie said, starting to cry. She wanted to tell him about Rye's betrayal, about how the pain of it had somehow caused her miscarriage, and still she couldn't stop loving him. But Henry was too good a man for that. If she told him the truth, he'd stay with her, give her time, tell her she deserved better than a man who'd lied to her. She had no doubt that there was no future for her and Rye. She didn't fool herself about that. But just knowing that he was alive made it impossible for her to pretend to love Henry enough to marry him. Slowly, she took the engagement ring off her finger, gave it back to him.
"I can't marry you, Henry."
She saw his struggle with emotion.
"You should talk to someone, Frankie. The new VA Medical Center offers therapy for vets. It can really help to talk to someone."
"I'm sorry,"
she said.
"I love you, Frankie,"
he said, his voice cracking on emotion.
"You'll find someone better."
"Jesus, Frankie. You break my heart."
"Henry."
"And for a woman in love, you have the saddest eyes I've ever seen."
Frankie left the hospital in a wheelchair, like an ancient woman, wearing a pad to absorb the bleeding. Dad pushed the wheelchair and ordered the local nurses around as if they were employees under his charge. Mom pulled up in front of the hospital, and they both helped Frankie into the passenger seat of the new Cadillac. At home, Frankie crawled into bed. Mom stayed in the bungalow, trying to distract her, as if such a thing were possible, until Frankie begged her to go home. "I'm fine," she kept saying. until at last there was nothing left for Mom to do but leave. Alone, Frankie reached for the purse on her nightstand. She took a pill for pain, and then two sleeping pills. She closed her eyes, lay back, drifted. Through a haze that captured her heartbeat, she heard the door open. Frankie didn't open her eyes. She was hanging on by a thread here. The last thing she needed was an audience. She could feel her mother watching her, worrying, but she didn't open her eyes. She was deeply, profoundly tired. Exhausted, actually. Her last terrible thought was, "He's alive." And then, it was all a lie. 30. For the first time in a long time, Frankie started to wake up on her bedroom floor again. She didn't know why the brutal nightmares of Vietnam had come back now. Maybe it was seeing Rye, or maybe new trauma reawakened old trauma. All she knew was that there was no way for her to pretend she was okay and soldier on. Not this time. The pills her mother had given her helped to take the edge off of her pain. She learned that two sleeping pills softened the nightmares and helped her fall asleep, but when she woke, she felt lethargic, unrested. One of the mother's little helpers perked her right up, maybe even gave her too much energy, enough so that she needed the pills again to calm down enough to sleep. It became a cycle, like the ebb and flow of the tide. She stopped visiting her parents, stopped answering the phone, stopped writing letters to her friends. She didn't want to hear their pep talks, and no one wanted to listen to her despair. To keep busy, she took extra shifts at the hospital. Most nights, she stayed in the hospital as long as she could, putting off the inevitability of having to go home. Like now. Long after her shift had ended, Frankie was still in her scrubs and cap, standing by the bedside of an elderly woman who was in the final stages of lung cancer, that terrible time when the body almost entirely shuts down, stops taking in food, stops any sort of intentional movement. The patient was frighteningly thin, her hands curled into claws, her chin tilted up, her mouth was open. Her breath was that gasping death rattle that meant time was closing around her, but she hung on to life stubbornly. Frankie knew that four of her grown children and all of her grandchildren had been to see her today, all of them having been told that the end was near. But now, at 11:21, Madge had no visitors, and yet she hung on. Bright crayon drawings covered the window by the bed. Fresh flowers scented the hospital's disinfectant air. Madge was waiting for her son. Everyone knew it. Her husband groused about it while her daughters rolled their eyes. Lester, everyone seemed to think, was too far gone to say goodbye to his mother. Frankie applied some Vaseline to Madge's dry, colorless lips. "You still waiting for Les, huh?" she said. Nothing from Madge, just that wheezing death rattle. Frankie gently took hold of the woman's hands and massaged lotion onto them. She heard the door open and saw a young man with lots of frizzy hair and huge sideburns walk into the room. A mustache hid much of his mouth, and a beard grew in tufts along his jawline. He wore a dirty pro-row t-shirt and baggy, rust-colored corduroy pants. But it was the tattoo on the inside of his forearm that caught her eye, the word airborne above a bald eagle head. She knew that insignia, the Screaming Eagles. The family had called Lester a drug addict and a thief and said that he made candles at some commune in Oregon. No one had ever said he was a veteran. "Lester?" she said. He nodded, looking lost, standing in the doorway. He might be high. Or just broken. Frankie went to him, gently took him by the arm, led him to the bed. "She's been waiting for you." "Hey, Ma." He reached slowly for his mother's hand, held it. Madge took a great rattling breath. Frankie moved to the other side of the bed, backed up to give him some privacy. Lester leaned down.
"I'm sorry, Ma."
Madge whispered, "Less," and took one last breath, released it, and slipped away.
Lester looked up, his dark eyes full of tears.
Is that it?
Frankie nodded. She waited for you. He wiped his eyes, cleared his throat roughly.
I should have come sooner. I don't know what's wrong with me. I just... Vietnam, man.
Frankie moved closer to the bed. Yeah, I was at the 71st, Central Highlands, she said, from 67 to 69. He looked at her.
So we're both the Walking Dead.
Before Frankie could respond, he turned away from the bed and left the room, slamming the door shut behind him. His presence and his sudden absence left Frankie feeling jittery, unsettled. Without bothering to take off her scrubs or change her shoes, she left the hospital. We're both the Walking Dead. He'd seen her in a way that cut to the bone, saw what she was trying so hard to hide. She was driving over the Coronado Bridge, listening to Janice belt out Peace of My Heart when she reached over into the passenger seat, felt around for her macrame handbag, and pulled out her sleeping pills. There was no way she'd sleep tonight, and remaining awake, remembering, was worse. She fumbled to open the cap at a stoplight on the island and swallowed a pill dry, wincing at the taste. At home, she parked and got out, a little shaky on her feet as she made her way into the house, where the phone was ringing. She ignored it. She should eat something. When had she eaten last? Instead, she poured herself a drink and took another sleeping pill, hoping two would be enough to get her through the night. If not, she might take a third. Just this once. That spring, Tony Orlando and Dawn released Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree and reminded America that even though the war was over, there were still soldiers coming home from captivity in Vietnam. Overnight, yellow ribbons began to appear on tree trunks around the country, especially in military towns like San Diego and Coronado. Bits of yellow fluttering in the breeze to remind Americans of the POWs in captivity. Stories of heroes who'd been shot down and imprisoned for years filled the news. Frankie couldn't get away from the stories and the memories they raised. She survived one day at a time by keeping to herself, not saying much. She got a prescription for the pills she needed, worked as many hours as humanly possible, and visited her parents when they demanded it. She talked on the phone in short, expensive conversations with Barb and Ethel, most of which ended with Frankie's adamant and dishonest, "I'm fine." The letters she wrote to her girlfriends were long and chatty and filled with half-truths and pretense, not unlike the letters she'd written to her parents from Vietnam. In May, her parents invited her to join them on the brand-new Royal Viking Sky cruise ship for a month at sea. Frankie declined easily and let out a deep breath when she saw them off. Now there was no one to pretend for. She could be as alone and reclusive as she liked. Finally, she thought, she could mourn without anyone watching. Despite her best intentions, Frankie couldn't seem to pull herself back from the edge of despair. If anything, the solitude and silence settled so heavily on her that sometimes she found it hard to breathe unless she took a pill, which she often did. By the end of May, she had refilled her prescriptions twice. It was easy to do for any woman these days, but certainly easy for a nurse. In June, an unexpected weather front hit San Diego, a deluge that the local TV weatherman claimed came from the Hawaiian Islands. In the middle of the night, Frankie was unexpectedly called in to work. Although she still felt a little lethargic from last night's sleeping pills, she popped another pill to wake her up and agreed. Without bothering to shower, she dressed in yesterday's clothes and headed for her car. As she drove over the bridge, rain pounded on the convertible roof, sluiced across her windshield so hard the wiper blades could hardly keep up. On the radio, a story about the Watergate hearings droned on, secret meetings, the president, blah, blah, blah. All she heard was the rain, pounding, rattling, monsoon hard. Blood washing across her boots, someone yelling, "Hit the generators!"
She clung to the wheel. In the hospital parking lot, she parked and ran into the bright building and went to her locker. Peeling off her damp clothes, she dressed in her scrubs and sneakers. She put on her surgical cap and coiled her long black ponytail up inside as she walked down the busy hallway toward the front desk. Even inside the building, she could hear the rain, shuddering against glass, pounding on the roof. At the nurse's station, she guzzled 2 cups of coffee, knowing it was a bad choice when she was this on edge. It was the rain, reminding her of Vietnam. She should eat, but the thought of food made her sick. Every time she closed her eyes, images of Vietnam assaulted her. Fighting them weakened her. Thank God it was a quiet shift. Just as she had that thought, the double doors at the end of the hall banged open. A pair of ambulance drivers rushed in, pushing a gurney into the bright white glare. Blood.
GSW!
Someone shouted. The patient was wheeled past Frankie. She saw him in a blur, blood pumping from a chest wound, pale skin. He was screaming,
Frankie!
She ran after the gurney into the OR, but she felt dazed, untethered by memories, images. She was slow at scrubbing in, couldn't remember for a second where the gloves were kept. When she turned around, a nurse was cutting off the kid's bloody jacket. Silver blades snipped through the fabric, and then his bare chest. A gaping bullet wound, pumping blood. Choppers incoming. Chinook. Thwop, thwop, thwop.
Frankie. Frankie!
Someone shook her, hard. She looked up, realizing in a flash that she wasn't in Vietnam. She was at work, in OR 2.
Get out of my OR, Frankie! Dr. Verminsky yelled. Ginny, you scrub in!
Shame overwhelmed Frankie.
But out!
He yelled. She backed out of the operating room and stood in the hallway, feeling lost. The damnable rain. Frankie woke on her bedroom floor, her head pounding, her mouth dry. Summer sunlight streamed through her window, hurt her eyes. The memory of last night's shame made her groan aloud. She stumbled to her nightstand, reached for her pills, and swallowed one with water. She passed the closed nursery door on her way to the bathroom. She hadn't gone into the room in months, not even to clean. If she had the energy, she'd gut it, paint over the cheery yellow walls, give away the furniture. But she wasn't strong enough to even open the door. She took a hot shower, washed and dried her long hair, and pulled it back into a loose ponytail, and then dressed in shorts and a t-shirt. The phone rang. She glanced at the wall clock. 12:20 on a Saturday afternoon. Barb. Frankie knew her friend would keep calling until Frankie picked up, so she grabbed her beach hat and chair and left the house. Carrying the chair across the street, she set it down in the sand. As she stared out at the glittering blue waves, she remembered last night again, the way she'd frozen in the OR like some FNG fresh off the plane. She couldn't go on like this. She needed to quit taking the pills and get her life back on track. But how? She pulled the hat lower on her head and pulled her sunglasses and a tattered paperback copy of Jonathan Livingston Seagull out of the chair's side pocket. Maybe the bird could give her some much-needed advice on how to live. The beach was a hive of activity on this hot June day. Kids running around, teenagers in packs, mothers running after their children. It soothed her, these familiar beach day sounds, until she heard a man shout out,
Joey, come back from the water. Wait for me.
Frankie felt her skin tingle, even in the heat. She looked up slowly from beneath the wide brim of her sun hat. Rye stood at the shoreline, facing this way, wearing shorts and a faded gray navy t-shirt. The summer sun had darkened his skin and lightened his hair, which was long enough now that she knew he'd left the navy. He moved in an awkward, limping way to keep up with his daughter, Joey, who giggled and tried to jump over the low roll of incoming surf. His wife sat on a blanket not far away, wearing a billowy summer dress, one hand tented over her eyes, watching them, laughing easily.
Be careful, Jojo!
Frankie sank deeper into her chair, hunched her shoulders, trying to disappear, and pulled her hat down lower. Look away. She couldn't. It was bad for her, maybe even dangerous, to watch Rye with his family, but she couldn't get up, couldn't stop looking at him, and the easy, loving way he was with his daughter. It had been a day just like this when Rye had shown up in Kauai, standing over her, saying, "I swear I'm not engaged." God, how she loved him. She heard his wife, Melissa. Her name was Melissa, Frankie knew from reading about them in the newspaper. Melissa yelled something, and Rye and Joey moved toward her, him limping. They were close enough now that Frankie could see he was gritting his teeth. Ugly scarring encircled his wrists and ankles. He knelt awkwardly in front of his wife, grimacing again in pain. Help him, Frankie thought. Melissa, help him. But his wife just sat there, packing food back into a wicker picnic basket. They look unhappy. No, he looked unhappy. The thought was there before she could protect herself against it. And after all he'd suffered. Stop it, Frankie muttered. They were a family, the Walshes, and their happiness, his happiness, had nothing to do with her. She knew their true story now, how they'd met, how they'd married, the hardware store that her parents owned in Carlsbad, the managerial job that waited for him when he left the Navy. Look away, Frankie. This was wrong, sick, dangerous. Frankie finally forced herself to get up. She turned her back on them, folded up her chair, and walked off the beach.
Damn it, Melissa, slow down!
She heard Rye's voice behind her and froze. Then she gritted her teeth and kept walking, over the mound of greenery and down to the sidewalk and across Ocean Boulevard. On the other side, against her best intentions, she turned slowly, stared at them from beneath the brim of her hat. He and his wife and daughter were leaving the beach, heading toward the street. Frankie had to leave, now, before she called out to him. She clamped the chair to her side and walked resolutely down the block toward her house. All the way there, she thought, "Don't look back, Frankie. Just let him go." But he knew she lived on Coronado, or at least that she'd been raised here. Did it mean something that he'd brought his family here, to the beach she'd so often talked about? She stopped at her car, which was parked in the driveway at her house, and looked back. Now, Rye was opening the trunk of a metallic midnight blue Camaro, putting the picnic basket inside. Melissa opened the passenger door and helped Joey into the back seat. Rye closed the trunk and limped toward the driver's side door. Frankie opened her car door, tossed her things in the back seat, and slid into the driver's seat. She plucked her keys from the visor, started the engine, and backed into the street. Slowly, her foot light on the accelerator, she drove forward, edged toward the stop sign on Ocean Boulevard. Rye got into the Camaro. The engine started up with a roar. She followed him. Them. All the way across town, up Orange Avenue, over the bridge, she berated herself. This was stalking, embarrassing. He didn't love her. He was a liar. Still, she followed them, drawn by an obsessive need to see his life. If he was unhappy? No, that was something she couldn't think. In San Diego, Rye turned onto A Street, which Frankie could see instantly was a street full of Navy families. American flags hung from many of the porches. A few lonely yellow ribbons still fluttered from the tree branches. Most of the POWs were home, but "Tie a Yellow Ribbon" was still a radio hit. On this summer afternoon, the street was full of kids and dogs and women walking side by side pushing strollers. He pulled up in front of a pretty, craftsman-style bungalow. The yard was a scrabble of discarded toys and roller skates and doll clothes. The poorly cut grass was brown. Frankie pulled over to the side of the road, the engine idling as if she might come to her senses soon and drive off. But she didn't. Melissa got out of the car. Holding Joey's hand, she walked up to the house,
pulling Joey inside, leaving Rye to carry their stuff. Rye moved slowly in his wife's wake, obviously in pain, carrying the basket and blanket. In the middle of the path to the front door, he stopped. Frankie slunk down in her seat.
I'll never do this again if he doesn't turn around, she promised herself, and maybe God.
She peered up through the window, saw him start walking, limping in a hitching, painful way. He slowly climbed the porch steps, holding on to the handrail. At the closed front door, he stopped again, as if he didn't want to go in. And then he opened the door and went into his house, back to his wife and child. Frankie moved slowly back to an upright position, put the Mustang in gear, and drove forward. As she passed the house, she slowed, staring at the front door, feeling a toxic combination of longing and shame. Rye opened the front door, stepped out onto the porch, and saw her. She hit the gas and sped past him.
Idiot! What had she been thinking? She was still in turmoil when she got home. A gin on the rocks did nothing to lessen her anxiety. She kept looking at the phone, thinking he'd call, wanting him to, not wanting him to, knowing all he had to do was call information to get her number. After all these years, she was still Frances McGrath on Coronado Island. But the phone didn't ring. Before the world even started to darken, she took two sleeping pills and climbed into bed. What time did the phone ring? She wasn't sure. Bleary-eyed, lethargic, she climbed out of bed and stumbled into the kitchen and picked up the phone. Hello? It was still daylight outside. The next day or the same day?
Frankie? It's Geneva Stone.
Her boss. Shit.
Hi,
she said. Was her voice slurry? Were her words coming too slowly?
You were supposed to cover Marlene Foley's shift tonight.
Oh, right, Frankie said. Sorry, I don't feel well. I should have called in sick.
There was a long pause. In it, Frankie heard both displeasure and alarm.
Okay, Frankie, I will find someone else. Get better.
Frankie hung up, unsure the moment she heard the click of the line if she'd said goodbye. She stumbled onto the sofa, fell sideways onto the cushions, pulled her legs up, and lay down. Tomorrow, she would get her act together. No more pills, and definitely no more stalking. She wouldn't even think of Rye Walsh. No more.
Frankie sat in the director of nursing's office, stiffly upright, her hands clasped in her lap.
So, Mrs. Stone said, her gaze steady on Frankie's face. You froze in the OR, during surgery, and you missed a shift.
She waited a beat.
We're sick.
Yes, ma'am, but... She stopped. What could she say?
I know the trouble you're having, Mrs. Stone said gently. I lost a child myself. As a woman, a mother, I understand. But... She paused. This isn't your first incident in the OR, Frankie. Last month...
I know.
Perhaps you came back to work too quickly.
I need to work, she said quietly.
Mrs. Stone nodded. And I need to be able to count on my nurses.
Frankie drew in a shaky breath. Her life was falling apart. No, it was exploding. Without nursing, what would she have to hang on to? I can't lose this.
It's not lost, Frankie. You just need to take a break.
I'll be more careful. I'll be better.
It's not a conversation we're having, Mrs. Stone said. You are on leave, Frankie, starting now.
Frankie got to her feet, feeling shaky.
I'm sorry to have disappointed you.
Oh, honey, I'm not disappointed. I'm worried about you.
Yeah. Frankie was tired of hearing that. She meant to say more, maybe apologize again, but the sad and sorry truth was that she should be sidelined. She was unreliable. How was she supposed to put the pieces of her life back together when she kept breaking apart?
Frankie slept fitfully, unable to get Rye off her mind. A terrible, dangerous obsession had taken hold of her. Every time she closed her eyes, she thought of him, remembered him, loved him. Over and over again, she saw him standing on his porch staring at her. The more she imagined that moment, the more she thought he'd looked sad at her driving away. Or was she lying to herself, manufacturing a dream from the shards of a nightmare? At just after 6 p.m., the phone rang, and she went down to the kitchen to answer it. "Hello?" she said, picking the princess phone off the counter, dragging the long cord over the counter so she could open the fridge.
"Hey, Frankie," Barb said. "You said you'd call on my birthday."
Shit. "Happy birthday, Barb. I'm sorry, busy shift last night." She thought about pouring herself a glass of wine and then closed the fridge instead. Today, she vowed. Today she would do better. "Did you have a good one?"
"I did. Met a guy."
"A guy?" Frankie pulled the cord back over the counter. She turned on the stereo, Roberta Flack, and settled on the sofa with the light blue phone beside her. "More, please. Salient facts."
34, ACLU lawyer, divorced. He has 2 kids, twin boys, 5-year-olds.
"And?"
"We met standing in line for Shaft in Africa, if you can believe it. We sat together and then went out for drinks afterward, and, well, we haven't stopped talking since."
"Wow, that's a record for you, Babs."
"He must be special," Barb said.
"He is, Frankie. I was starting to think it wouldn't happen for me, you know? That I was too militant, too angry, too everything. But this guy, his name is Jer, by the way, he likes all of that about me. He says lots of women have soft curves. He likes my sharp edges."
"Wow," Frankie said again.
She was about to say more, ask a question about sex, actually, when the doorbell rang.
"Just a sec, Barb. Someone's here."
She kept the phone to her ear, carried the handset with her, and went to the door, opening it. Rye stood there, wearing his aviator sunglasses and a sea wolf's cap pulled low over his eyes. She started to shut the door. He put a foot out to stop her.
"Please,"
he said. She couldn't look away.
"I gotta go, Barb."
"Is everything okay?"
"Sure," she said evenly, surprised at how calm she sounded. "Happy birthday again. We'll talk soon." Frankie hung up, held the phone balanced in one hand.
"You shouldn't be here."
"You shouldn't have followed me home yesterday."
"I know."
"I saw you on the beach," he said. "I was hoping to. It's why I picked Coronado, by the Dell. You always talked about it."
"Did I?"
"Isn't that where you surfed with Finn?"
She swallowed the lump in her throat.
"Why are you here?"
"I know why you followed me. It means you still..."
"Don't."
He pushed his way into her house, took the phone from her hand, set it on the counter. She felt robotic, confused. She couldn't let him stay, but she couldn't seem to form the words to make him go. He closed the door behind him, and suddenly he was close, touching distance away, taking up too much space in her living room, just as he did in her heart.
"You lied to me," she said, but the words didn't have the edge she intended. They sounded sad instead of angry.
"Frankie."
The way he said her name brought back so many memories, moments, promises. She shook her head.
"Leave. Please."
"You don't want me to go."
"I don't want you to stay."
"That's not the same thing. Come on, Frankie. I know you know it was real between us."
"Real and honest aren't the same thing either, are they?"
He reached for her. She wrenched out of his grasp, stepped back, putting distance between them. She needed a drink.
"You want a drink? Just one. Then you'll go."
He nodded. She went to the cabinet where she kept the liquor, realized she'd bought scotch for him at some point along the way. She poured 2 drinks, handed him one.
"Outside,"
she said, afraid that in here, so close, he'd try to kiss her and she'd let him. She went to the patio door and stepped out into the backyard, noticing the changes Henry had made. A tire swing hanging from the tree, a fire pit around which were four Adirondack chairs, an explosion of color along the fence, roses, bougainvillea, jasmine, gardenia. When had she let the grass die? Rye limped over to the fire pit area and sat in one of the chairs. Frankie sat across from him. "Tell me the truth," she said. He didn't pretend to misunderstand. She was grateful for that, at least.
"I married Missy 2 months before I shipped out on my first tour. She..."
"Wait, Missy?"
"Melissa. I call her Missy." "I know who you are, Missy," Rye's father had said to her all those years ago. He'd thought she was his son's wife.
"Go on."
"I was young, stupid. I wanted someone back home, waiting for me. And she was pregnant."
"So it was all an elaborate ruse, the engagement you supposedly broke off. You swore you weren't engaged. Swore it."
"And I wasn't."
"Did Coyote know the truth? Did all of your men, were they laughing at me?"
"No. I never wore a wedding ring, never talked about a wife. I wasn't long in country before I realized that I had made a mistake getting married. I figured we'd get divorced when I got home. I never felt married. And then I saw you at the O Club, remember?"
"I remember."
"It hit me like a ton of bricks the way I fell for you. It wasn't like anything I'd felt before. Maybe you can't understand how a baby can turn your head, make you do the wrong thing for the right reason. I told myself I'd learn to love Missy, and then I met you."
Frankie knew what he meant. She'd said the same thing about Henry. But it hadn't happened, had it? Intention couldn't force the heart.
"I knew it was wrong, but I couldn't tell you the truth, and I couldn't let you go. I thought, after I got home, we'd work it all out, and I'd find a way to leave Missy and be with you. Then I got shot down. For years, everyone thought I was dead. They held a funeral and buried an empty casket next to my mom. And then finally, Commander Stockdale got word out. After that, Missy was my lifeline. She wrote me religiously."
She believed him. Was it because she wanted to, or because she was lonely, or because she felt the truth in him? She didn't know, but it was dangerous, this loosening of anger. Without it, all she had was love. "I can see that you suffered," she said quietly. "Your leg?"
"Broke it jumping out of the Huey."
"What happened?"
"I hardly remember it, really."
He didn't look at her. His voice went dead, became rote. She imagined she was being told the story he'd recited a dozen times in debrief.
"I came to when I hit the ground. I saw the Huey above me burst into flames and go down."
He drew in a ragged breath.
"I landed hard, saw the bones sticking out of my pants leg. Next thing I knew, I was being hauled to my feet. Charlie cut my clothes off me, dragged me, naked, left me in the middle of some muddy road. I could hear them yelling at each other in their language. They kicked me, rolled me over, kicked me some more. I tried to crawl away, but my leg hurt like hell by then, and I kept bleeding from the bullet in my shoulder. They tell me it shattered the joint."
Frankie imagined him lying in mud, naked, his body broken and bruised. Rye was quiet for a moment.
"And then, the Hanoi Hilton," he finally said. 4 years and 3 months in a cell. Leg irons."
Another deep breath, released slowly.
"They had this rope they used to force my body to bend over. Kept me that way for hours of interrogation, weeks of it. And then, one day, when they were dragging me back to my cell, I heard other prisoners, American voices. That was my first moment of hope, you know? They finally moved me to another cell, one close to Commander Stockdale's. The other POWs had figured out a way to communicate."
His voice broke.
"I wasn't alone."
He paused, collected himself.
We talked, sent messages. I learned about McCain and the others. I got my first letter from Missy, telling me she'd never given up on me, and I needed her, needed that. So I tried to forget you, told myself it was for the best, thought you'd be married by the time I got home.
If I'd known, I would have written. Your dad told me you'd been killed in action.
You went to see the old man? What a treat.
He looked at her.
I tried to let you go, Frankie. Told myself I'd been a cad and done you wrong and you deserved better. Told myself I could learn to love Missy again, or maybe for the first time, but I saw you in San Diego on the tarmac. One look at you and it all came crashing down. I want you, Frankie. You.
He moved painfully to a standing position. She rose at the same time as if she were a planet in the orbit of his sun, drawn by an elemental force to follow him.
Do you want me, Frankie?
The sadness in his voice ruined her resolve. She took his hand, felt the familiarity of his grasp.
What you're asking? What you want?
She said, wanting it too.
It would destroy me. Us. Your family.
I'll leave Missy. I can't even touch her without thinking of you. She knows something's wrong. I can't bear to kiss her.
Don't ask this of me, Rye. I can't.
They grounded me, Frankie. I can't fly anymore.
She heard the loss in his voice, knew what flying meant to him.
Oh, Rye.
One kiss, he said. A goodbye, then.
She would never forget this moment, the way he looked at her. The love that came roaring back into her soul, suffusing her with all the bright emotions she'd lost in his absence. Hope, love, passion, need. She whispered his name as he pulled her into his arms. At first, all she noticed were changes. He was so thin, it felt as if she could break his bones with her passion. And beneath the scent of his cologne, she smelled something almost like bleach. Even the way he hugged her was different, kind of one-sided, as if his left arm didn't quite heal to his command. In his eyes, she saw the same awakening in him, a reanimation of life. She saw, too, all that he'd been through in captivity, a red scar that cut across his temple in a jagged line, the bags beneath his eyes, the gray in his blonde hair that underscored their lost years. At the first touch of his lips to hers, she knew she was doomed, damned. Whatever it was called, she knew it and didn't care, couldn't make herself care. She had already given up everything for this man, this feeling, and she knew she'd do it again, whatever the cost. She loved him. It was that simple, that terrifying. When he whispered,
"Where's the bedroom?"
She knew she should say stop, tell him to come back when he was divorced. But she couldn't. He'd brought her back to life. God help her.